Welcome back to another issue of Christian Doctor's Digest. It's always great to share some of my friends with you information that I think you're going to find particularly helpful. We've got a theme, this issue of children, how to be a better father, dealing with children in danger, talking about orphans and father-children projects, just all sorts of things that I think you're going to find helpful not only in your own family, but also in your practice. So let's jump in, meet some new guests and some old friends. Let me introduce you to a good friend, Rob Brandt. He's a general surgeon for 25 years, then had a nationwide practice as a medical quality improvement consultant for hospitals. He's been a member of CMDA since 1960. He must have started at age two or something like that. He's had an interesting life, served in the U.S. Army in Europe and later worked with the Navajo Indians. He's visited all seven continents, even been to Antarctica. Not too many people that can say that. But he and his wife, Ruth, have a special interest in children and has written a wonderful little book called You Deserved a Better Father. And we got together to share some of the insights of that book, which I think will be particularly helpful to you as they were to me. Rob, one of my favorite books is the one you wrote. I love this book. It's called You Deserve a Better Father. And I do want to get to why you wrote this book and kind of hear the story.
Well, I grew up in a Christian church, and I thought I was a decent father. But when we lost our oldest son in the accident, which is in the book, and I realized, actually, interestingly enough, losing Rob actually strengthened my faith when it put the spotlight on the reality that God elected to give his only son for me. And that nudged me toward becoming a more focused, intentional father, which definitely involves some planning, which is a concept in the book, too. If we just expect our fathering to occur spontaneously without any planning, much of it may never occur. And I need to say right up front, I don't think I was a particularly good father, but I certainly was a better father after Rob's death and after I got myself a little bit organized.
Tell us the story of what happened. I mean, you had a very busy surgical career. You were in the military. You've done missions on Indian reservations. You know, and as I read the book, I thought, wow, holding you up to a lot of fathers, I thought you were doing a pretty decent job in the midst of a busy schedule. But tell us some of those particulars, because I think it really wraps this the principles into some things that really grabs our heart.
Well, I had an experience with, you know, you might hear among spiritual people, how much planning should you do, and, you know, or should we just fly by the seat of our pants and depend on Lord, you know, to work things out because we have faith. But one of the key points in my journey was to realize that in light of the Bible, in light of biblical principles, in light of what we see in nature, God himself was a planner. And I gave more detail about that in the book, but that's a verifiable concept. So I thought, well, you know, I'm so careful about planning my investments, my vacations, where I'm going to live, where I go to church, and so forth. But when it comes time to shaving in the morning, do I really focus on part of my job description for that day is being a dad? Hmm. And so what are my specific plans for that day, that week, that month to fulfill those job description issues being a dad? So part of this is putting an element of planning into it, but of course one must be careful, as with everything in life, to stay balanced and not go to extremes. The best plans can go awry, and so we need to be flexible and allow for the Lord to intervene with maybe a better plan. And then we actually set up sort of a schedule, if you would. It would be like a family menu or schedule, and you know, we were active in church, as per most of our listeners probably, but I made a commitment that every Monday evening, and I operated Monday morning, Monday afternoon in the office, and, you know, you never know when you're going to get out of the office, but I had a wonderful wife and children who allowed the flexibility that whenever I got out, if it was 7 or 8 or even 9 o'clock at night, I would go with one of my children alone for dinner. And it's no other distractions, hopefully, one-on-one, eyeball-to-eyeball, hey, what's going on in your life? And during that experience, one of the lessons I learned was that I should listen, and that I learned that I never learn anything about my child while I'm talking.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also set up a little scheme for Friday night, family night, no guests, no friends, just our family, if it was popcorn and whatever, some kind of activity. But again, it was to be focused on each other, on what the biblical principles are for families. As they got older, of course, there has to be some flexibility built into that. But when they were small, it was a very focused activity. Probably the thing that Ruth and I took, the step we took, which would be considered the most extreme today, but we're the most content about it, is the fact that we decided to have family devotions every school day morning at 7 o'clock. And the arrangements where the school was, that worked out for our schedule. And ironically, even though I was one of the busier surgeons in my community, there seems to be a little bit of a dead time between 5 o'clock and, you know, 7 when there's relatively few phone calls. So that worked out very well. We began by leading the devotions myself or my bride, Ruth. And then as the children grew, we allowed them to grow into that function, and we would take turns around the table. Then as they got in high school and had to think about their SATs and other tests, why we would throw in a vocabulary word. And that was actually, we invited them to try to stump us, which they regularly did. But interestingly enough, the kids really hit their SATs and vocabulary. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, that was just a little side thing.
I think it's so good, Rob, because you know, too often we plan so well in other areas of our life, education, CME, church activities and all the rest of it, and family, if anything, gets the leftovers, and often nothing constructive is happening. We just may be in the same house, but it's really not family activities, and a plan is so important.
Well, I think particularly today, even more so when more children are small, I mean, we've just got to recognize that the landscape is filled with IEDs. They're not mm-hmm. only in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we as fathers really need to protect our family by enveloping them in some armor, you know, that's really going to keep them focused and protected. And busyness, you know, doctors, most of them are busy, and it's a major issue. Too often it's an excuse for fathers not doing their job, but the reality is the busier we are, the more important it is to be organized and to have a fathering plan. Clearly, in the observation that Ruth and I have, the most obvious opportunity that's overlooked is mealtime.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many families now that don't even have meals together. And if I were a father raising children this day and age, I would insist that there's at least one meal a day, you know, on the majority of days when we're together, when we're looking at each other's eyes, talking about how things are. And then another concept to rewind just a minute. With these morning devotions, the concept that I tried to embed in them was this. Okay, here's the Brand family gathered around, you know, after Rob died, we had four children growing up. What are the issues that face the Brand family today? Then, what are the biblical principles that are relevant? And to try to make the Bible a living, breathing document like the legislators are trying to make the Constitution that now. And then Proverbs. We're great fans of Proverbs. We think every parent should go through Proverbs at least once a year with their family and go line by line, no rush, really try to see the application.
One of the things in the book you talked about was taking your boys and going on camping trips in the fall and the spring. Talk a little bit about that when the guys got together.
Well, you know, some people have pushed back on this because they don't like to camp. In fact, we have one son that thinks camping is anything below a Class 5 hotel. but he does, but to give him credit, he does a lot of things with his kids. So, you know, it doesn't have to be camping is my point. But we just happen to love camping. And by the way, I have another son who loves groveling around in the dirt with his boys. Camping, to me, the point of that was to pull back from the practice and try your best to separate yourself from the busyness and have just a period of focused fathering where there's nothing else on your agenda, nothing else on your plate but these kids. Look at them in the eye, teach them. They're like little sponges. You know, and you give them your spiritual faith, you give them your politics, you give them your values and all that, and you do it while you're having fun. But for those who are not campers and don't like to get dirt on their fingernails, they're just pick something, but I think it needs to be overnight, so it's very special for the kids that you're with. And the idea is just focused, intentional parenting, fathering. And then in our case, now, this is perhaps a different age now, but I did things just with my boys, and Ruth did, took our daughter Rosalyn off for another special weekend, but parallel but different.
Yeah.
In our discussions, we talked about some sexual things and sexual education and some of the perversity that exists in the world and how to react to it.
I still remember what you taught in the book, and I read in asking the boys, tell me all the dirty words you've heard at school lately. I thought that was a great question, because they're hearing them, and you need to be there and explain what's going on and how they deal with it.
Exactly. I just want to be a part of what they're thinking, you know, because they can easily be embarrassed by that and not, and might have thoughts that they're, you know, pure as a driven snow and not being exposed to these things, and that could not be the case. It may not be the case, and so we need to delve into that.
Well, let's move to a couple other things real quickly before we finish. One, and you and Ruth have done such a great job, is mentoring younger couples. For folks at your age and my age, we realize more and more the importance of passing on to the next generation and young couples struggling with these issues. Talk a little bit about the principles that you apply in your mentoring with younger couples.
Well, how it came about quickly was that when our children had grown and gone and we had empty bedrooms, some of the younger couples in our church seemed to come up to us and say, Rob and Ruth, would you please pray for this or that? And some of their prayer requests to me seemed to reflect the fact that they hadn't had good fundamental biblical counseling or, you know, training. And so we put together this idea of spending a weekend together with couples, and we usually had four couples. And it was basically a mentoring thing where we would include, the basics, relationship to God, husband-wife relationships, parent-child, and then, of course, evangelism. And so we put those four subjects into a weekend, plenty of fun, plenty of break time. And this is a subject we still love. We're still pushing this, and we're actually in the process of trying to hand it off to some of the middle-aged couples now. But we've got some terrific feedback from these couples who, I remember one gentleman just saying to me, hey, man, that permanently improved our marriage. To get them alone again, it's retreat time, it's separation time, focus on the topic of their marriage and their children. Biblical principles, experiences, and allowing them to share. And very importantly, at the end of it is goal setting. We got a little pushy with them, and said, now, okay, this has been nice to talk about, but what are you going to do,
Mm-hmm.
And what changes are you going to plan to make in your family? So it's one of the things in our lives we really are happy about and highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's a real legacy you've left. Let's talk one other topic. You talk about your, how many grandchildren now? 8, 10, something
10,
like
10.
Yeah. Talk about your influence on your grandchildren and how God's led you in that area.
Well, I think that's it's actually a weakness in our family because all of our children live quite distant from us. But when I'm with them, again, I try to take, when they come in for a weekend or a week, why I take one at a time out for breakfast and do that same little drill that I did with the boys camping,
Mm-hmm.
Ask them what they like about school, how's church, what do you like the most about church, and of course to make sure they've actually prayed to trust Christ, and just being with them, certain things rub off,
Yeah.
I have a red pickup truck, and some of my boys' grandchildren said, you know, I want to go to Grandpa and ride in this big red pickup truck. And there's just certain good things that happen from just hanging out, you know.
Yeah, yeah, spending time.
And I think the modeling is very important. They watch everything you do, you say, your attitude. And sometimes the modeling is much louder in nonverbal than verbal things.
Yeah, yeah. Rob, you've given us a lot to think about, and the book is so rich with the stories and the illustrations and then the practical advice on things you can do. I just want to thank you for taking time to share with us what God has taught you, and I know your book impacted my life, our family, and I just want to recommend it highly to those that can get a copy of it. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for all you're doing.
You know, I've already had one round being a dad, now second round being a granddad, and the advice that Rob gives is so practical at whatever stage, even if you're just looking forward to marriage and a family sometime in the future, just some thought-provoking things. And I'm so reminded that the thing that really makes a difference is the time that we spend with our children. And those experiences that we have with our grandchildren, the time we spend together, really helps mold them for a lifetime. If you'd like to get a copy of Rob's book, it's available here at CMDA. You can get it at cmda.org or give us a call at 888-230-2637. Jim, let's talk a little bit in our tax-wise moment about giving not only appreciated gifts, but de-appreciated gifts. I mean, we've had some bad economy going on, and people have been stuck with things that are costing them money. Kind of talk about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The last couple months, we've had a couple members who have approached us about helping them take some property, some real estate off their hands, where they bought it either as investment property or with the idea of building a retirement home there. And the property has depreciated in value to the point where they can't sell it. It's underwater. So they're exploring the possibility of contributing it to a charity like CMDA.
Yeah, and they have ongoing expenses with mortgages and homeowner association fees and
property taxes.
Yeah.
So in some cases, it does make sense to give away a depreciated asset rather than continue to incur those expenses on it.
And it's a huge blessing to us. I mean, to have someone think of CMDA in that way and help us financially and to expand and grow and make our ministry even a greater success than appreciated assets. I mean, the stock market's at record highs.
Absolutely. And we're seeing an uptick in the number of members who are talking to us about giving appreciated assets like stock. Gold is still at record highs. Silver. Last month, we even had a member give us a stamp collection.
So you really kind of almost double dip. You get the gift deduction, plus you don't pay capital gains. So
absolutely, yeah. It's a great way to save taxes and provide for a ministry like CMDA.
What do people need to do if they want to explore this? Maybe somebody's out there saying, oh, man, yeah, maybe I should do something like that, but I'm just not sure. I need to see the numbers. What do they need to do?
Well, the first step would be to give us a call or send us an email at stewardship@cmda.org, and we could often work with the donor or with the donor's financial advisor or accountant in helping them really think through what are their financial objectives. In some cases, could they claim a capital loss? I mean, some of these real estate investors that we're working with, depending on their individual tax situation, they might be able to claim a capital loss on a piece of real estate and then carry that forward for a period of up to 5 years. So it really depends on the individual's circumstances, but the first step would be to call us, put us in touch with their financial advisor or accountant, and see where the conversation goes.
And if people want to do that, they just give us a call at our toll-free number, 888-230-2637, and Jim will be happy to talk to you and help you. It's just a real blessing to us when people think of CMDA and the ministry that only we as healthcare professionals can do, and at the same time realizing that those finances are going to go to touch people's lives and help them grow in the Lord and bring people to Christ and literally reach around the world. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
had a fascinating conversation with my daughter not long ago. Jessica's expecting our second grandson, and we're really excited about that. But she said, Dad, what do you think? We're considering our third child being adopted. You know, I'm seeing that trend among a lot of young couples, and it really excites me because the Bible teaches us clearly that we're to take care of orphans. And that's why I think you're going to enjoy this conversation with Jed Medefin, who serves as president of the Christian Alliance for Orphans. That's a coalition of 120 organizations and also a national network of churches working together to inspire and equip Christians for effective adoption, foster care, global orphan initiatives. Jed's got a really broad experience. He served in the White House as a special assistant to President George W. Bush, leading the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. Previously, he held a range of posts in the California State Legislature. He's worked and studied and served in more than 30 countries, from working with Price Waterhouse in Moscow to Christian Life in Bangladesh. He's an author, and most importantly, he's a follower of Jesus Christ. He and his wife, Rachel, live in California with their five children. Let's listen into this conversation. Jed, it's great to talk to you about the Christian Alliance for Orphans. Tell us about this group. Why do you guys exist? What is your mission?
Well, you know, the Alliance is a gathering of more than 100 organizations that are all committed to living out the Bible's call to care for orphans in distress. And so that looks a lot of different ways. It's foster care in the United States. It's adoption. It's also caring for orphans in other countries. And all of these organizations are doing great work on their own, but they've really decided they can do more in unison than working completely in isolation from each other. So they're really working to inspire and equip the church, really light a fire into the church to personally engage in these issues as a reflection of the gospel.
What are you seeing happening in churches across the country? I sense that there's more interest and desire, especially among younger people, to be involved in adoption. Is that correct?
It really is, and it's just a remarkable thing. Traveling around the country and just listening to folks in small churches and big churches, everything in between, and there's just a real passion to, as often I hear people say, I want to live that pure and faultless religion that James talks about, caring for the orphan and widow in distress, and adoption is a primary expression of that. And then often adoption leads into other ways of caring for orphans, because when you have become so closely intertwined, so deeply caring for a particular child that you know would have grown up without a family had you not adopted them, suddenly it wakes your heart to the, you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of children that are facing that situation right now, and draws us deeper into seeking to care for orphans in partnership with local believers in Ethiopia, in Guatemala, in China, and it's really beautiful to see how that vision is growing and waking in the church.
Is adoption as easy as it used to be? I mean, the impression I get is that it's a more involved, more costly process. Some countries are limiting it. What are you seeing around the world? Because I know the desire is there. What are the opportunities to adopt?
You know, adoption really is a challenging process, and no one should seek to adopt lightly. First of all, and most importantly, because this is a lifelong commitment to a precious child, and in a sense like marriage. And so just as you wouldn't go into marriage lightly, making this commitment to a child is something that anyone that's pondering that should very much do so with prayer and thoughtfulness and understanding the potential challenges that a child might have coming from an orphanage or an abusive situation in the U.S. foster system. Those are the most important things to consider, but it's also important to consider that the pathway to adoption can be very challenging as well, whether that's internationally, where you're dealing with complex international situations and also significant costs. But then domestically, if you're adopting from the foster system, the cost issues are not there, but you're also dealing with a very tangled government system and many very painful situations that these children have come through. And so you're going to be both in the process of adopting as well as afterwards enjoying both great pleasures and joys in these children, but also facing real challenges.
And sometimes those are emotional, sometimes psychological, sometimes physical, depending on their age and what they've been through. How would you speak to healthcare professionals out there? I mean, they stand at the crossroads in dealing with couples with infertility issues, for example, and often hear about their desire to adopt or have the opportunity to influence couples who may be having their own children decide they want to adopt as well, which I see increasingly, and to help kids from around the world. What do they need to know? Where do they need to be sending people? How can they help promote adoption to their patients?
Well, you know, that's a multi-layered question, and I really feel like the most important time for a couple to weigh some of these issues of medical technology and fertility questions is actually before they get there, if that's at all possible. And so, you know, for a doctor who deals with these issues, to encourage their church, their pastor, to make that a part of marital counseling, I think is actually a really wise approach, so that a couple can kind of think about it in an abstract and an emotionally less complicated way, and consider, you know, how far they would go in harnessing what is possible in terms of the medical fertility technology and those sorts of things. And so I think that's why, you know, once a couple is in that situation, and you know, often very unexpectedly so, I think it you know, would be very helpful for any doctor that is talking with a couple about these things to at least make the various options that are out there known to that couple in terms of both intercountry adoption, domestic adoption, privately as well as through the foster system. And while, you know, it's obviously emotionally a very charged time and a delicate matter, I think a Christian doctor doing that can be a real service both to that couple and to the kingdom of God.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's easy when you get into an infertility workup to just to go deeper and deeper, really not having made a conscious decision how far you want to take this. And I think that's a mistake sometimes patients regret, because they look back and see all the money, time, energy, emotional stress that they've gone through. Some of that, though, can happen in adoption as well. Not always successful. You think it's going to happen. It's not going to happen. Talk a little bit about that, because it's a challenging thing to deal with.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that we often talk about at the Christian Alliance for Orphans is just how adoption mirrors the gospel story. John Piper's actually referred to it as the visible gospel, you know, because we live amidst this amazing story of the God who pursued us when we were destitute and alone, and he draws us to himself and adopts us and invites us to live as his children. And so when Christians choose to adopt, they are in many ways replaying that story in a small way and reflecting it to the world. And so it's a beautiful thing. At the same time, we know that the gospel story also includes great costs, that God came to us at infinite cost to himself, and it includes the anguish of the cross. And so, you know, any parenting journey, of course, is going to include real costs and challenges, and adoption is certainly no exception to that, that both in the process of adopting as well as following the adoption and caring for a child, if they bear wounds and bringing them to wholeness, that can be a journey that mirrors the gospel story as well. And so whenever we talk with families that are considering that, we want them to both understand both the beauty and the spiritual significance, but also the challenges that they could face along that road.
And it can be so fulfilling. I just this past weekend was up in Alaska and was with a couple, staying with a couple who their children had adopted some kids from Ethiopia. And it was just a joy to see the relationship they had and how these two young men had just blossomed in their home and grown to love the Lord. And, you know, we can focus on the difficult part of it, but the joys of doing what God has called you to do is just indescribable. No less than going to the mission field or getting God's calling in some other way and answering it. What resources does your organization bring to bear that can help healthcare professionals? As, you know, they're talking to someone, they're dealing with some of these issues you've talked about, and now they're saying, okay, where do we connect? Where do we find an adoption agency, a Christian one in particular? What are the options out there? Take us through some of that.
Well, you know, the Christian Alliance for Orphans membership standards require a high level of both fiscal accountability and good governance, as well as a fundamental commitment to the gospel. And so all of the agencies that are a part of the Alliance are committed to those things, and we feel very unequivocal in being able to say, you know, a family can really feel good about adopting through these agencies. case, because that's not always the case. There are many agencies, I would say most all of them mean well, but some are not run particularly well or do not have a solid Christian commitment, even though they may go under the name of a Christian agency. And so just finding quality agencies through the alliance is, of course, one helpful element. And then we also have a great resource library within the alliance website at CAFO.org, CAFO.org, where families and professionals and others can go and draw resources and materials, and we're continually developing those as well. We have a monthly webinar that often addresses kind of some of the key issues facing both adoption, foster care, as well as other facets of caring for orphans around the world. The National Summit, which is our national conference in May each year, addresses many of the key issues, both in terms of the parenting of children coming from difficult backgrounds and a whole host of related issues as well, both, again, the joys and celebration as well as the challenges. And so, you know, both the website and Summit itself are great resources.
What would you say to parents, and I'm sure there's some listening to this, that are considering adoption? What words would you summarize this with?
You know, I would just come back again to the fact that adoption mirrors the gospel both in its beauty and in its costliness. And it's not something to be done on a whim, but for those who choose it, who choose to mirror God's profound love for us and adoption of us, and then mirror that in an action towards a child who otherwise would grow up without a mom and dad, there is great joy there. I can say that personally because I've experienced it, and I can say it on behalf of just so many families and friends whom I know, some of whom have gone through great difficulties, but almost all whom would say it was worth every moment of it, just like all of the most important things in life, whether marriage or having children biologically. These are some of the most challenging things in life and some of the most beautiful.
Yeah. Jed, I want to thank you for being with us and for your commitment and the commitment of the Christian Alliance for Orphans to carrying out the gospel, living it out in this world, and being there to help other people walk down this path. We really appreciate it.
Definitely my pleasure.
I trust this information is going to be helpful to you. And remember that website, ChristianAllianceForOrphans.org, a great resource for you to recommend to patients. And I think we as Christian healthcare professionals need to carry this banner in our churches, in our profession, in our practices, in our community to help take care of orphans. What a wonderful example of that is to everybody of how we've been adopted into the family of God. You know, I love Dick Swenson, and we get him on every chance we get. But something you didn't know, you're going to find out in this interview. Because when you think of Dick Swenson, you think of Margin and Overload and Hurtling Towards Oblivion and all the books. And you think about him as a futurist and talking about what's happening in medicine. Well, we've got something else totally different than all of that. I'll let Dick explain. Dick, always want to catch up. Talk about The Last Flight Out of Oz. I bet you some people out there haven't read your novel. They've been missing out and may not even known that you have been writing. Tell them about it.
Yeah, this is a book that Adam and I worked on for 11 years. And I mentioned that we started our own little publishing company. We'll probably bring out a book a year with that, as well as some e-books. And I've noticed that the print media is being shaken, and so you see there's a new democratization of publishing. There are a lot of people, if people have not ever been published before and have a hard time getting published, a lot of their options should be looking at probably e-books. You can go straight to Kindle, or Smashwords is the thing that is a platform that will stick it over on a Nook or the Apple products, and you don't have to pay a penny to get launched with that. Of course, distribution is always the hard part of it, but people are breaking in. I mean, there's some people that are breaking in that have no platform whatsoever, and they have no expertise or influence or reputation, and they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year with their books, so it's just kind of an interesting deal. But if you look at Christian bookstores, too, there's a shaking of the whole Christian world, and I think we're being marginalized in our Christian books. And look at fiction, and I've read probably 30 or 40 Christian books in my last, in the last 40 years. I've enjoyed them too. But most Christian books now are romance, And Christian books are written by Christians for Christians. More than 85% of Americans will never buy a work of Christian fiction because they're construed in a certain way. There's a high wall around the laws of how you do Christian fiction. And like I said, most of them are romance. And I don't know if you've ever read any Christian romance, but I have. I mean, Janet Oakey, is that her name? I think I read three of those. I like a chick flick with Linda. We'll sit down and watch that. But I really like epics. I mean, I like Gladiator. I like 24, you know.
You're right, right. Me too.
And so very few men, Christian or not, will ever pick up a book of Christian. Now, we have people in CMDA that write good Christian fiction. But I can tell you there's a lot of Christian men who are writing fiction that want more latitude with what they're producing, and it's just simply not permissible in the current situation. And so I'm saying there's 260 million Americans who will never look at Christian fiction, but like 20 to 35% of the words out of Jesus' mouth were fiction. He talked parables. He talked stories, and he did it again and again and again because that communicated with people. My suggestion is we have two tracks. We have the current track, which is inspirational for millions of Americans, and evangelicals buy more books than any other subset in American society. And so they need to be able to have their pure books that are good for them, that lift them up, that have good endings, and that don't have all the coarse society that you see even on just primetime television. But we need another sector, another track of Christian fiction that is more honest in terms of engaging the culture, because God is not afraid of pagans. I think that's a surprise to anybody. Jesus hung out with pagans. He sought them out, and he intentionally tried to reach those people. So Adam and I, if you read this book, Last Light Out of Oz, is about three brilliant people. One's an atheistic Jewish professor who is just off the charts brilliant, but a broken man, and he feels responsible for the death of his wife and child. And one is an unpretentious new Christian student, engineering student in Colorado. And then there's Maggie, and she's so smart, and she's from Stanford, and she's the unapproachable goddess of Stanford engineering, and she's just very, very smart and has her own plane, and she comes from a very corrupt but wealthy family, and she's a nominal Buddhist. And when Anthony Weisman, the genius, disappears, these two students fear that he is going into terrorism because he's so unhinged, and they have to find him. And so it's this exchange of these characters. They're all very, very intelligent, but it's an intelligently written book. There's a good plot, very good, I think, dialogue. Adam's responsible for most of that, and even a little romance between Kevin and Maggie.
Yeah, a little romance in there, right?
He can't handle her, you know, but I mean, his hands are just absolutely full, but he's way, waist deep about, you know, he's beyond himself, but she's such a character. And at the end of the book, guess what? The Christian worldview wins. There's four Christian characters in this book. At the end of the book, the Christian worldview triumphs, but there's no conversion scenes. Hmm. You know, to do a conversion scene would have been clunky. It would have been cheesy. It would have been wrong because it's not what would have happened. Maggie is pulled in the direction of faith, and Anthony is saved because of Kevin, because of his heart, you know, who risks himself to go save him. And who knows, maybe there'll be a sequel. We'll have to see. But we intentionally targeted the book. It reads more like a secular book, even though faith is all throughout the book. But we want it to be outside of the traditional Christian genres and to open up this separate track. I think strategically we're going to stand before Christ, and he's going to say, why did you do this? I mean, you had this powerful tool of Christian fiction, and you decided you were going to exclude 260 million people who need it most from a witness and a testimony from Christian writers who are very good at their craft, and yet you do it in such a way that they simply are not interested in it at all. So there's like about prime time level realism in here in terms of honest characters. We have Maggie saying some words that Maggie would say. We've toned her down 90%, and the same with Professor Weisman, but Maggie's dad is just as despicable as it's possible to be. And so we finally allowed Christian fiction to be about the level of, like I said, primetime television or the average PG movie, mm-hmm. or even listening to Rush Limbaugh or something. Okay,
right.
I downloaded 50 books of George MacDonald for $2.99 on my Kindle. And I mean, that's just crazy. But he wrote 150 years ago. C.S. Lewis credited him as the greatest influence in his Christian life. And I'm reading one of these books, and all of a sudden, in about a five-page span, I noticed that he's describing one of these horrible you know, barons, these aristocrats in old England. And he used three words. I mean, that old aristocrat used three words, which would have excluded George MacDonald for getting published in Christian Fiction Today. And so I am opposed to the coarsening of our society. And I never use vulgar words, and I have not used one in my entire life. And I don't drink alcohol at all. And I've never touched a woman besides my wife. I mean, you know, I'm just not the person that should be fighting this battle, and yet there's much at stake. And if we could open up a second track without sinning, an author can write certain things and maybe put the H word in somebody's mouth. That is not sin. I'm not taking the Lord's name in vain. It's vulgar language, and I would never use it. But we have to be honest in terms of the characters, and if we don't go there, they never will respect our literature.
Yeah.
So we have to have good literature, good plots, important topics, and the topic here is on tightly coupled systems. And that's the thematic vehicle that carries the entire thing. And the genius professor is convinced that tightly coupled systems is going to lead the world into cataclysm. And personally, I'm the one who wrote all his text, and I agree with him. So it's a way of learning about tightly coupled systems in the world system and how they're increasingly becoming more so and very dangerously so. And so if nothing else, it's just a good educational trip. But
yeah, it's a great book, and I'd be the first one to say it. And thank you for, I don't know how you produce all these things with everything else in your plate, but God has used you in a marvelous way, Dick. I want to thank you for being with us, giving us some of your time, and I know how precious it is, and you've been a blessing to me, and I know every member of CMDA is going to be eagerly listening to this interview because they're always wanting to know what you're thinking and what God's revealing to you. So thank you for being that voice on the wall and for all you do for us.
Thanks, Dave. And by the way, the book is, we heard last week, it's nominated for two book awards. We'll find out next week if we got them or not, but there are three books that are finalists in each category. Adam entered us in two, so we'll find out whether we got the award or not. But,
wow.
I mean, that's awesome. So we're having a lot of fun with it. Well, thank you, David.
God
Lord
bless.
Bless you, brother.
Well, can I have the results, please? Yeah, Dick won that award with his son Adam for Last Flight Out of Oz. In fact, they won both of them. And so this is an award-winning book, and I've read it. It is fun. It is a great thriller, mystery, excitement. It's something totally different. If you need a good book for a weekend break or vacation, this is the one to get. You can give us a call at 888-230-2637. Or go to cmda.org, get your copy. You'll enjoy it tremendously. And I got some other great news. Dick is going to be at the CMDA's 2014 Winter Conference. It's going to be held here at headquarters February 21st through the 23rd. Mark that on your calendar. He's going to be talking about his latest book that's just coming out this summer called Contentment, The Secret of a Lasting Calm. I've already read it. I endorsed it. One of the publishers said it's the finest thing he's ever written, and I agree. And so this is a huge issue in our culture and our own personal lives. So join us February 21st through the 23rd for some time together with Dick. You'll enjoy it tremendously. You can find out more about it on cmda.org and register online or give us a call if you've got questions. You know, CMDA is involved in a lot of issues, but one of the ones that's closest to my heart is how we've been taking the lead in the issue of human trafficking, not only at the national level, but really trying to equip healthcare professionals to be able to identify and help in the rescue of victims. And we're going to talk about that. But the first thing I want to do is increase your awareness of this problem. And I couldn't think of someone who could better do that than Dina Graves of Traffic 911. It's so easy to think this is a problem in Thailand or Cambodia or Central America, but this isn't happening where I live. Well, it is. And Dina's eyes were open to what was happening in Dallas, Fort Worth, and northern Texas. And as she shares some of that story, I think it'll open your eyes as well. Dina, how did you get involved in human trafficking? And this has become a passion for you.
Yeah, definitely a passion and a life goal now. I was working as a leader in one of Texas Instruments business units when I learned about human trafficking in third world countries. And I made the comment to a friend of mine who's a Dallas police officer that I couldn't believe this happened in third world countries. He told me it happened here, and I could not believe that. I thought we are a Christian, civilized country, and we would not do that to our children. But what I soon learned was that we do it. We're just much, much better at hiding it.
What did you do about it? I mean, here you are, a busy businesswoman. Your whole life was changed.
Yeah, the Lord told me I was going to quit my job and start Traffic 911, and we argued a little bit about that, and he won out. So I ended up quitting and starting it, and 3 years later, I'll tell you, I've never seen so many miracles and been a part of something that is so amazing and so life-changing, although it's, you know, you're down in the enemy's camp constantly battling evil.
And when you talk about the ministry, kind of give us the scope of what you're doing, because it's a combination of things.
Yes, Traffic 911 has a three-part strategy: prevention, rescue, and restoration. And we have multiple programs under each of those. We work really hard in the deterrence area as well. We've had multiple felony arrests, multiple identifications of victims and rescues. And our biggest goal is to prevent this from happening so that kids don't have to try to recover from this horrific atrocity.
And what about the restoration end of it? What do you guys do in that area?
Well, we right now treat them on an outpatient basis, but we're in the process of opening very quickly Triumph House, which is a home in Texas. It's a 168-acre ranch where we will give these kids holistic healing, including the faith-based side of it.
Yeah, and it's so important to have a safe place, and it's not an easy process, I know, to bring these kids back from what they've suffered through. What is the key for professionals? I know that you're really working to get professionals, especially medical professionals, aware of what's happening in this area. Why is that so important?
Yeah, there was a case out of Missouri that really drives home why this is so critical. A doctor or another first responder might be the only person that ever has the opportunity to identify one of these kids as a victim and get them out. Their average life expectancy is only 7 years once they're forced into this. In the case from Missouri, a little girl was taken by five men, including the Postmaster General for the state of Nevada. They not only sold her, but they advertised that you could sexually torture her and live stream that over the internet for other people to watch. And one of the people who bought her took him up on that. He was electrocuting her, and as he did, she went into cardiac arrest. They had had her for several years at this point. Normally did not take her to the doctor, but she was about to die. They took her to the ER. That ER doctor had been trained on domestic minor sex trafficking, recognized the signs, and got this little girl out of 7 years of terror just by recognizing what was happening.
You know, so many healthcare professionals don't have training in this area. What should they be looking for? What questions should they be asking? How can they be on the alert to be the savior for these little kids to bring them out of these horrible situations they're in?
Yeah, and we actually have a wallet card if any doctors or medical professionals would like them, that tell them these signs. But a few of them they can look for: malnourishment, poorly formed or rotted teeth, mutilations, STDs, rectal trauma, urinary difficulties, pelvic pain, infertility, vaginal bleeding, torn colon. The list goes on and on because these children are tortured and so physically abused. And then there are also general signs that people can look for, such as tattoos that say daddy, or a barcode or money bag, something like that. Runaway and homeless children are extremely high risk for this. If you have someone come into your practice or the ER who has an older controlling boyfriend or woman who will not let them talk very much, that's another huge sign that they are under a pimp's control. Very scripted answers or inconsistent stories. So many, many signs that they can look for to give them clues.
You know, it's easy to think, I know you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and often we think of this as a big city problem or an overseas problem. this is all around us. Interestingly enough, our headquarters in Northeast Tennessee in the Bible Belt. And, you know, I was looking online. There's 174 arrests in the last 2 years in our area for human trafficking. And it's so easy to think this isn't around me. And it is. Here in Tennessee, they find child trafficking in 72% of our counties. What do you see nationwide? I know you work not only at the local level, but you're very involved at this, you know, in a broader scope as well.
Yeah, it is everywhere. And one of the things we found, traffickers move these children around frequently to keep from being detected by law enforcement. And one of the things they'll do is take them to the smaller outlying areas to get away from big city law enforcement that's a little bit more trained on this. For instance, there's a little town in Texas called Brownwood. We went there last week, did a training, and we were able to find a case before we went of a little girl who had ran away from home. A man drove about 150 miles to come pick her up, took her to one of our military bases in Texas, and sold her around the military base.
Mm. And it's not just sexual trafficking, too. I mean, there's servitude, there's other things going on, and though the vast majority of it involves females, it involves little boys, and it involves people forced into work situations as well. So it's a broad problem.
It is, but the greatest way it is happening in the United States is our American children being forced into sexual slavery. And what happens is it's hidden in plain sight right underneath our noses. For instance, we trained Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth, Texas. And before we trained them, they had identified zero victims of domestic minor sex trafficking. Within 8 months, they had identified 11 victims.
Wow.
So it's happening all around us. You just have to know what to look for. And remember, you might be the only person who is that child's escape out of this.
So let's say I'm a busy family practice doc, and I have a case, some symptoms and signs that you described. I suspect something's going on in the midst of a busy day with, you know, a whole list of other patients to see. What should I do? How do I respond? Give us some education.
Well, let me first say, if you're out in the general public and you suspect a child is a victim, do not approach that child or the trafficker directly, as you could get the child beaten and yourself put in danger or your family. But if you're in the hospital or in your office, you have a unique opportunity to help these children where you would call 911 out in a general public setting. What we recommend you do in a case like that is that you would tell that trafficker that you have an office policy or an ER policy that you must examine the child without them present, and you separate the child from the suspected trafficker. You call 911 and you try to keep that trafficker busy, engaged in paperwork or something like that while you're waiting for 911 to get there.
Yeah, don't tackle this alone. And people are eager and willing to help. I think, too, is not only train yourself, but train your staff, because often your office personnel, your nursing personnel, the people in your emergency room, or may even have a longer amount of time observing what's going on than you will in a short visit. So it's not just a matter of educating yourself, but then educating others.
That's right. We encourage anybody in a job that works with children to get training on this issue, because you never know if you're going to be that one person that comes across that victim.
And then after you educate yourself and your staff, you can begin educating your community, because doctors are looked to for expertise on this and other issues. And you can serve your own community in this way through community organizations and others that are in contact with children that may be victims.
That's absolutely right. We always need doctors to help us with physical care of these children and in other aspects like that as well.
What am I forgetting, Dina? What else do we need to tell our members?
Well, these children are living in captivity. Some of them are kept in dog kennels or chained under trundle beds. We had one little girl that was sold in 57 men in 4 days. She was stabbed in the back, locked in a car trunk, drugged. Another little girl we have was sold in 6 states in 30 days. So with an average life expectancy of just 7 years, we just say we don't have time to wait. There is a lot of attention on human trafficking in other countries, but not funding and attention and awareness on what's happening in the United States. And we just need people to engage with organizations like ours to save these children, because Jesus first ministered in his own country and then he went out, and we need to not overlook our own children as we're trying to help in other countries as well.
Yeah. Dina, I want to thank you for what you're doing, for the example you are, for the training you're giving, for your faithfulness, for your boldness, your courage, willingness to leave your job and start this outreach, and most of all, for taking time today to teach and train us. Let us know your website. Where can people get more information?
Yes, it's www.traffic911.com, and traffic is with a CK for human trafficking.
Thanks so much. God bless you.
Thank you.
One of our goals here at CMDA is to equip you so you not only will have knowledge, but you can train others. Did you know until recently there was nothing in the United States to train healthcare professionals in how to identify and rescue human trafficking victims? And yet studies show that the best chance to rescue someone is when they come with a medical problem. But in those instances, they found that none of the doctors in that study actually realized the problem and did anything about it. We stepped up and said, well, we need to do something about this. This is an important issue. And some of our members with expertise in this area have created an 11-module study series that's online. It's free for you to get to. If you want continuing medical education, you can get credits for it. There's a small charge for that. So I encourage you to go through these modules, get your education, share them with your colleagues, teach one or two modules to your medical staff at the hospital. You'll find this information is compelling and will be well appreciated as people become aware of this issue. Go online to cmda.org/tip, which stands for Trafficking in Persons, cmda.org/tip, or go to the front page of the CMDA website. Towards the bottom, you'll see a link to this information. You'll be part of the solution. That's something that each one of us needs to be. You know, it's springtime, one of my favorite times of the year. Some of you may know one of my hobbies is flower gardening with Jody, and it's always great to get out and get dirt under my fingernails. But you know, the other thing that happens in the spring of the year, we are finishing our financial year, which actually is June 30th. And one of the things, well, I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you, I really don't enjoy is dealing with money. I mean, I'm very ministry focused. How can we touch people's lives, help them grow in the Lord? How can we speak the truth in love and bioethics and public policy? But the bottom line is, we need money to operate. And this year has been particularly challenging. I think people are still concerned about what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act and what's happening in the economy and all the rest of it. But if we ever needed a strong CMDA, we need it now. With the crisis that's happening in healthcare, with all the many changes, we're just inundated with people asking for help and assistance. Doctors dealing with malpractice, people dealing with bioethical issues at the bedside, things we're dealing with in Washington, and right of conscience. And we've got a new bill before Congress and really trying to motivate, mobilize people to support that. You know, just so many areas where CMDA is making a difference in people's lives and in our culture. I got a note today from the head of the CMDE Commission, and she said you might be interested in these. Her comments from the missionaries that just finished the 10-day Continuing Medical and Dental Education Conference we did in Thailand for them. There were over 90 volunteer faculty there, and over a couple hundred hours of continuing education offered, a spiritual life speaker, spouse program, kids program. I wish you could have read those comments. I mean, my heart was just warmed. A missionary from a country there in the Far East said, you know, I was just about ready to quit. And I was just so reminded that through this conference that God had called me. I was encouraged by other colleagues that are going through the same things I am. And I'm going back invigorated and renewed and ready to go. Another one says, well, I don't know where I could have gotten my CME in a better place than here, as I hear real stories of how people are facing the same issues that I'm facing in my practice. And thanks for what you did with my kids. And one lady said, I could actually hold my husband's hand in public. I work in a Muslim country, and I could sit there and hold his hand and not have to have my head covered. I mean, you just see how God is touching so many lives, and stories from students and graduates and residents as they go through challenging times. CMDA is making a difference. And I know you know that, just as I do. Well, as we face this challenging time, I've got good news. We had one of our former trustees step up again this year and say, David, I'm going to give $100,000 as a true match. And first of all, I want to challenge the board and former trustees to match that. And they stepped up and said, we'll match up to $163,000 more. So we have a matching fund of $263,000. So for every dollar you give, another dollar will be given by these group. If we can make that match that $263,000, we're going to end this year in the black and even have a little positive amount to jump into this next year from an extra strong position to do some things that need to be done that aren't part of our budget right now. Would you consider helping us? Give sacrificially. I thought when I was praying about this and thinking what I would say, I thought, David, you need to lead from the front. You need to be an example. And Jody and I made the largest gift we've ever made to CMDA just a week or so ago. And I want you to give sacrificially. We have no one else that supports CMDA other than our members. And as you know, our membership dues only cover about 15-18% of our budget each year. So your gifts make the difference, and I encourage you to give sacrificially. And as we do, I believe even greater days are ahead, because in the midst of crisis, God does His best work. We have unprecedented opportunities to touch our non-Christian colleagues, to be a witness into our culture, to speak out in Washington and make a difference. Our influence there is at an all-time high. So now is the time to press forward, not to drop back, to be even more effective in what God has called us to do. You can just drop us a note, stick in a check. You can give online by going to our website if you want to use your credit card. However God moves you, maybe it's with appreciated assets, a gift of stock, whatever God lays on your heart, we're happy to help. But as we come together, work together, we can end this year strong. I know we can meet this goal. As I heard someone say when we were raising funds last year at the national meeting to help start a medical school, the first medical school in southern Sudan. The good news, we already have the money. The bad news is it's still in your pockets. I know the funds are there. With all of us giving generously, God's going to do exceedingly above anything we imagine. So I encourage you to do this. Ask God what He wants you to do and do that. That's all that He expects. That's all that we expect. Until we get a chance to get together again, may God bless you richly, and be assured we're praying for you.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.